George Carlin started his professional career in radio in 1956 at the age of 19. In the 60s, he spent most of his time honing his style at small clubs with characters like the Hippy Dippy Weatherman. With appearances on television shows like Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and Ed Sullivan, Carlin became a household name. In the 70s, he assumed the irreverent and satirical persona for which he is best known and which has garnered him two Grammys for Best Spoken Word Comedy Album. He returns to his native New York for an HBO comedy special, and we are pleased to have him here. Welcome back.
And I'm pleased to be here. Thank you,
Jack. Number 9 on HBO.
My 9th stand-up show for HBO, yes.
And this one is live.
Well, I've done two previous ones live. The one in 92 of Madison Square Garden was a live show, and one of the earlier ones was live.
You said to me as we sat down that sort of you just learned how to put this whole thing together.
How to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah,
It
only noticed it in retrospect, so I can't really date it.
Yeah.
But in the last 7 to 8 years, I began to develop a different comic voice and a different perspective. You know, comedy, stand-up comedy is a low art. It's a vulgar art. It's an art of the people. It's not.
But it's an art.
But it is an art. It has to do with interpreting the world as you see it, and then writing something, and then delivering it verbally. And I found a very liberating position for myself as an artist. And that was, I sort of gave up on the human race and gave up on the American dream and culture and nation and decided that I didn't care about the outcome. And that gave me a lot of freedom from a kind of distant platform to be sort of amused, to watch the whole thing with a combination of wonder and pity, and try to put that into words.
Not caring about the outcome, what do you mean by that?
Not having an emotional stake in whether this experiment with human beings works. I really don't care. I love people as I meet them one by one. People are just wonderful as individuals. You see the whole universe in their eyes if you look carefully. But as soon as they begin to group, as soon as they begin to clot, when there are 5 of them or 10, or even groups as small as 2, they begin to change. They sacrifice the beauty of the individual for the sake of the group. I decided it was all under the control of groups now, whether it's business, religion, political people or what, and I would distance myself from wishing for a good outcome. Let it do what it's going to do, and I'll enjoy it as an entertainment.
And I'll reflect on what it is on its own.
And I'll enjoy it for the entertainment. There's a little bit of a sick part in this, too. Yeah. I root for the big comet. I root for the big asteroid to come and make things right. That's the way I put it.
Stir things up.
Yes, to get us back where we were before the first one came and knocked out these dinosaurs and let the ferrets
grow. We're talking about comets on this show tonight.
I know. And I'm rooting for that big one to come right through that hole in the ozone layer because I want to see it on CNN. See, I'm here for the entertainment, Charlie. I am. People, these philosophers say, why are we here? I know I am here.
For the entertainment.
The show. Bring it on. I want to see the circus.
But how does this affect your performance and what you bring to stand-up?
Well, I've seen a lot of comedians who seem to have a political bent in their work. And always implicit in the work is some positive outcome, that this is all going to work. If only we do this, if only we pass that bill, if only we elect him, if only we do that. It's not true. It's circling the drain time for humans. I believe this. I honestly believe this. Not just as a comedian, he thinks that. He likes to say that. Yeah. I believe it. And when you say to yourself, I don't care what happens. It just gives you a broader perspective for the art, for the words to emerge, to not care. That's what happened in that 92 show. That's why I could say the planet is fine, the people are... Because the planet will outlast us. It will be here and it will be fine.
We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. I'll save the trees, save the bees, save the whales, save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these fucking people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to help one another. We're gonna save the fucking planet? I am getting tired of that shit. I'm tired of fucking Earth Day. I'm tired of these fucking self-righteous environmentalists. I'm tired of these white, liberal, bourgeois, liberal, white people who think the only thing wrong with this planet is there aren't enough bicycle paths, trying to make the world safe and clean for their Volvos. And I'm really sick of these rock stars and movie stars gonna work off their cocaine guilt by saving a forest somewhere. Besides, there's nothing, first of all, the environmentalists don't give a shit about the planet. They don't care about the planet. Not in the abstract, they don't. You know what they're interested in? A clean place to live. Their own habitat. They're worried that someday in the future they might be personally inconvenienced. Narrow, unenlightened self-interest doesn't impress me. Besides, there's nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. The people are fucked. The people are fucked. Compared to the people, the planet is doing great. The planet has been here for 4.5 billion years, all right? 4.5 billion. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe. 200,000? Maybe. And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just floating around the sun? Planet has been through a lot worse than us for a long time. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, bombardments for hundreds of thousands of years by comets and asteroids and meteors, sandstorms, erosion of all kinds, cosmic radiation, worldwide fires, worldwide floods, recurring ice ages, and we think some aluminum cans and some plastic bags are going to make a difference. Planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. We're going away.
Has the subject matter changed?
Well, I you're still stuck with what's going on, but I don't like topical. I don't like political humor. I don't mention politicians. In fact, I defend them in this particular show. Everyone is on their case. Everyone is always making things.
Politicians are bad.
I defend them and blame it on the people. This is where it belongs.
Yes. You get what you deserve?
Yes, you get what you deserve, and you deserve what you get. And I have a slogan, the public sucks. And it works nicely, and people accept it. Not very enthusiastically, but they understand that it says we the people in that preamble. It doesn't say them the thises and those the thats. It says, hey.
We got on this boat.
And people who hate government are involved in a form of suicide, because government is self-government. And if you hate the government, you hate yourself.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the war against nature that mankind goes through. So I just said to myself, it's not going to get better, not in my lifetime. Let me enjoy this and get a little perverse about my commentary on it.
What does perverse mean, though?
Well, to look for where the people think the line is. The people have values, that these amorphous things they call values, that they bring to the seat in the theater when they sit down. Yeah. And I like to find out where their line may be and deliberately cross it, disturb them a little, make them uncomfortable, and then bring them with me across the line and make them glad they came. That's what I do. I'm an entertainer. I'm not a doomsayer. I'm not here to preach. I don't do political tracts. But I do entertain. I do a lot of jokes. But I want you to feel a little in danger along the way.
And so people who go to hear you ought to feel a little, ought to go in with a sure knowledge they'll feel a little endangered when they sit down.
Well,
watch the television.
It doesn't matter if they know it going in, as long as it happens when they're there. I just want them, because, you know, what happened about, you know, we talked about this little change of mind, whatever it is, this evolution, this latest thing.
When you got it together.
Yes, eventually, ultimately for myself. You have to be somewhat of an egotist to stand up all your life and say, listen to me, please pay attention. Even in school, when you do this in school, you're looking for attention.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I can live with that about myself. But if I'm going to call attention to myself, I want to show them something a little different from time to time. I want to find a voice that isn't like all the others. I just never want to be like all the other people. I just hate these. I could never do a Newt Gingrich joke or an O.J. Simpson joke or anything, because you sound like all the other people. And I just want to, you know, anybody who stands up wants to be different. Hey, look at me, guys. So I'm always looking for things I can believe in that challenge them a little.
Now, there's one thing you might have noticed I don't complain about. Politicians. Everybody complains about politicians. Everybody says they suck.
Yeah.
Well, where do people think these politicians come from? They don't fall out of the sky. They don't pass through a membrane from another reality. They come from American parents and American families, American homes, American schools, American churches, American businesses, and American universities, and they're elected by American citizens. This is the best we can do, folks. This is what we have to offer. It's what our system produces. Garbage in, garbage out. If you have selfish, ignorant citizens, If you have selfish, ignorant citizens, you're going to get selfish, ignorant leaders. And term limits ain't going to do you any good. You're just going to wind up with a brand new bunch of selfish, ignorant Americans. So maybe it's not the politicians who suck. Maybe something else sucks around here, like the public. Yeah, the public sucks. There's a nice campaign slogan for somebody. The public sucks. Fuck hope. Fuck hope. Because if it's really just the fault of these politicians, then where are all the other bright people of conscience? Where are all the bright, honest, intelligent Americans ready to step in and save the nation and lead the way? We don't have people like that in this country. Everybody's at the mall, scratching his ass, picking his nose, taking his credit card out of his fanny pack and buying a pair of sneakers with lights in them. So I have solved this little political dilemma for myself in a very simple way. On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. Fuck 'em. Fuck 'em. I don't vote. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. The shit they shuffle around every 4 years doesn't mean a fucking thing. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around, I know. They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote and you elect dishonest, incompetent people, and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, in fact, did not even leave the House on election day, am in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with.
How do you prepare the material? I mean, you write it down, you work it out, you try this and try that and winnow it down?
I'm extremely anal, so I have 35 years of notes. Some of them are still in hard copy. They're actual pencil-written notes. A lot of things are on discs now. But I've kept my files over the years, and I'm very familiar with them. And I think most writers or any artist would tell you that a lot of the work goes on subconsciously. If you're thoroughly familiar with your raw material, a lot of the synthesis goes on without you even knowing it, so that when you sit down to apply the thought, some of these things come rushing forward that you never heard before, but they're part of you. So I pay attention to my files, I have attitudes, and I save things according to my attitudes, write something out, revise it about 20 times before I ever put it on stage. And I do it in my real shows. I don't go somewhere and try it out in a club. Yeah. I do it for the people it's intended for, and it grows from there. And it's usually very close to completion by the time I put it on stage.
How much difference, once you have it and once you're good, does delivery make from night to night?
It's everything.
The pause, the inflection,
the
look, the
boom. Yes. That is the wonderful thing about the stand-up art, if we can use that term. It is one of the few, it's the only one I know of, the only art form where the intended receiver of the art is present at the delivery and the art form can be altered according to their appreciation of it as you go. Mm. Now, in my case, I don't change the words a lot, but they give me signals that gives me license to do more with my body, to do more with my face and my voice. So, except for a jazz musician who was also affected by his audience in an improv, everyone else is separated from their audience by time or space or by an arrangement or a key or a tempo. Not the comedian. He gets to do this according to how they appreciate him, and that's
do we know I mean how far back does this art form go, the stand-up, before a collection of people I'm here to entertain you?
I have often
nothing
said,
more than my voice.
I have often said, when people talk about, well, you know, you may not like the system and everything, but you make money from this and you're in business and all that. And sure, but I say, but you know, if I were forced to do this for free, I would. Yeah. If it were caveman days and I went from cave to cave telling my little stories in exchange for a hunk of meat, I would do it. And if they said no meat tonight, I would still do the show. And I think storytellers and shamans and oral traditionalists from primitive cultures probably are the forebears, the forerunners, I guess, of this art. And then monologists, although they didn't interact as much with their audience, the the famous monologists of vaudeville in the Chautauqua Circuit.
Bob Hope is a hero of yours.
Bob Hope in the movies. I never cared for his television political monologue stuff.
Why? Because it was too pat, too...
It was filtered through a commercial system.
Yeah, right.
We're selling trucks and tires here, folks, so we're going to filter things for you. But the movies never had that. At least it wasn't very visible. And I adored Danny Kaye. Yeah. And now think of me in the 40s. I'm about 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And they're in their primes in the movies. And Bob Hope in the movies... Red Skelton in the movies and Danny Kaye in the movies.
Were what?
They were something, because movies were larger than life. We didn't have television yet. It was a few years away. Radio was a big thing. But the movie, you sat there and the screen was so big and the theater was so big and it was this wonderful experience. And I said, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. And I used to write to Sylvia Fine to try to get Danny Kaye's lyrics. I never got an answer. Yeah. I didn't know they were married. And I said, Dear Miss Fine, please send me Get Giddle. I want to learn this and do it at school and stuff. And I just loved the verbal facility. I knew, I said, this is something I want, I can do. And I didn't know what form mine would take, but I knew I could stand
up. How about
the
Marx Brothers?
Absolutely. Because of the chaos. Because they kicked over every bit of order. And the wonderful thing, they could go through a hotel lobby, lighting a couch on fire, shooting the chandelier down, and the people only sort of looked slightly annoyed. No one panicked. No one called the police for this behavior. I loved that. Spike Jones on records, again, taking something ostensibly beautiful, breaking it down and destroying it in a way and making something else out of it, making chaos out of order and then order out of chaos.
But when you knew you wanted to do this, was it any of the people I've just mentioned or was it someone else that sort of spoke to you and you said, damn it, that's what I want to do?
Well, it came first, I think, before I saw or heard any of them. My mother and father were very verbally gifted. I didn't know my father, but he was a top advertising salesman. He was the national advertising manager of the New York Sun and before that, the New York Post, when it was a broadsheet. Mm. My mother was an executive secretary in advertising all her life. They were very funny.
Yeah.
And I inherited that. And my mother used to get me to imitate people. Do Mae West? I didn't know Mae West, but I knew how to imitate her. Come up and see me. I did Johnny the Philip Morris Midget. And one day I said something to my mother. This was mimicry, pure imitations. Mm-hmm. But one day I said something to my mother, funny, and I knew the difference between her real laugh and her social laugh. And I said something and I heard her real laugh. She really laughed at something I thought of in my head. And I thought, wow. And it just gave me a feeling of power. I don't remember what the thing was, but I knew I had made it up.
But you can feel the same thing today.
Yes.
It's the same thing.
It's the capacity
to know that an audience, whether you're making a speech or doing stand-up,
right,
that you can just feel them responding. I mean, it's almost like
of course, the comic
kinetic.
Has the laughter as proof every 5 to 10 or 15 seconds. And to know not only that, but Arthur Kessler said in The Act of Creation that sometimes the jester can traverse the triptych. And if the jester says something funny, well, he's a jester. If he says it in marvelous language that we say, oh, isn't that a nice way to put that? Then he's a bit of a poet. And if there's an underlying idea underneath the well-put funny line, if there's a bit of a philosophy in it, he becomes something else again, a philosopher. Now, one doesn't sit down and attempt to do that with everything he writes.
Yeah.
But to know that that's part of the package, to know that you can do these three things in varying degrees.
At this stage in your life, I mean, where are you in terms of what you want to do? You've learned this craft.
Yes.
You've got the perspective that, you know, you're doing it the way you want to do it. Is there some mountain that's still left to climb, or is it just simply sort of...
No, I have some... There are two things. I'd love to continue exactly what I'm doing and broaden the vision, broaden the horizon, and just see more and say more. And that'll happen.
Be smarter, more insightful.
Just find better synthesis, to find that this idea goes with that one and I never suspected, and then to make something out of it that's bigger than the two of them. But...
The other mountain.
The next HBO show, this is 1996, for 1999... I expect will be a Broadway show. I don't know how long it will run. I will attempt to do it for a month or so, you know, and see what happens. You can't get too far ahead of yourself. But I want to include a little production. I want to include some movement.
Yeah.
I don't want to forget who I am. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to run from my strength. But a little movement on stage, some characters, a hat for this character, a scarf for another. My mother, I want to do my mother on stage. It'll be semi-pseudo-autobiographical with a little bit of this in it, too, because I think I have things that I want people to hear. I don't know if they ought to, but I think I'd like to hear myself say them. And I think that is what I would like to do with this verbal thing next.
Carlin live on Broadway for HBO in 99.
Very possibly. I hope so.
This is the ninth HBO special. Mm-hmm. HBO has given you, it's meant everything
it's to been my lifeline.
Your lifeline.
Michael Fuchs in particular.
Yeah. Michael, by opening HBO up to comedy and giving you this opportunity, in a sense, has kept an audience out there in touch with where you were
That's
and
right.
what you were doing.
I had four gold albums in the early 70s, so that was over $1 million in sales, each one of them, and they were wonderful. And then I had two or three after that that weren't quite, you're never the hot guy in town forever. You have to understand when you're not the new hot guy anymore. And that period came, and that's when HBO came along. And it was my way to have a mass audience. I could have traveled for years doing these theaters, doing whatever they were, but I would only reach people 1,000 at a time. HBO, every 2 years on the average for me, gave me a mass audience, and their subscriptions grew over the years so that the audience was bigger and bigger. And it gave me a presence in the national mind, if you will. I don't mean to be too grand about this, but in the minds of people who appreciate comedy or entertainment in general, it gave me a presence. And the wonderful thing is that they don't interrupt you. You have a full hour to just go, and there's no censorship.
George Carlin, live from the Beacon Theater, March 30th. Thank you for joining us this evening.